Well, some plants seem to thrive no matter the conditions, location, or amount of care we give them happily, while others seem to be disease magnets. We're lucky to have two experts here to help us figure out what might be going on in our gardens and how to treat any problems we might discover. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at the UW-Madison. And thanks for joining us today, Brian.
No problem. Glad to be here.
And Laura Jell is a professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Welcome back, Laura.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, we have lots to talk about. We were just talking before the show that it's just been a strange year all around, and certainly that has affected our plants. So why don't we start with kind of the obvious question? What diseases seem to be really prominent so far this year? Laura or Brian, what have you been seeing?
Yeah, lots of rust diseases, and I've seen rusts on a variety of things that I usually don't see them on until later in the season, so we're way, way far ahead. So I had a penstemon sample come in with a rust. I'd never seen rust on that. We've been seeing actually some field and forage crops coming in with rust, particularly wheat coming in with some rust, which is we see routinely, but I usually don't think of it quite this early.
Is that because it warmed up so early?
I think so. We've had a bizarre season this year, and Laura can comment on how everything is very compressed in terms of flowering, and things are very, very early.
And let's get to that, but actually, let's explain what rust is.
Yeah, it's a fungal disease, and there are a variety of different fungi that can cause rust. They tend to be pretty host-specific. We tend to see a lot of them at the same time, but it's a different fungus, and it takes a little bit of detective work to track down exactly what it is. We had a teleconference this morning with our hort agents, and somebody reported rose rust, which is not one that we see that commonly, but I think because of the very mild winter that we had, that it survived here pretty well. And what we typically see with rust, the reason they're called rust is that one of the spore types that's produced by the fungus is oftentimes very rusty in color. It can be bright orange, can be kind of a rusty brown, but that's characteristic. And you can actually rub the spores off on your finger if you just kind of touch the leaves.
And is rust more of an aesthetic thing, or can it actually damage
the
plant?
It can be quite serious. Okay. One of the reports this morning was on Jack in the Pulpit rust, and that particular rust tends to go systemic in the plant. So even if you cut the plant off, the fungus is still in the crown, and it just continues to reinfect. And with a rust like that, we typically recommend to dig up those plants and remove them. And that way you don't get spores moving to other Jack in the Pulpit plants or relatives that will get the disease.
I really like Jack in the Pulpits. I hope mine don't get affected.
Yeah, what you look for is a lot of distortion in these bright kind of orange yellow spots.
Okay.
On the leaves
I'll
and on the plants.
On
yeah.
That. Well, Laura, so we're hearing about early diseases and things like the rust. It seems like everything is way ahead of schedule.
Oh, this is the first year I've ever seen roses in full bloom before the end of May. I mean, usually it's not until June. I'm seeing Japanese tree lilac, which normally blooms about the second to third week of June. It's in full bloom right now. So many plants have come and gone out of bloom when they normally bloom now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a very interesting year. I've also seen spider mites. Actually, I have some in my own yard, which is earlier than normal. It's been a very dry spring, and I think that's why we're seeing more spider mites. Other things that we're seeing, some wind damage from yesterday especially. Mm-hmm. A lot of trees have lost limbs or branches, or unfortunately some trees have plummeted over. So that is an issue that we have to deal with. Obviously, with 50-mile-an-hour winds, there's not much we can do to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have hanging limbs, obviously you want to get those pruned off because those are a hazard. If you can't reach them, I highly suggest you contact a certified arborist. And where to find a list of certified arborists is on the Wisconsin Arborist Association. Again, that's Wisconsin Arborist Association website. If you Google Wisconsin Arborist Association and you look under ISA Certified Arborist for Hire, and a screen will come up and you can search for your county. I would highly suggest you go there.
Would you like that website? I know that
yes,
one by
you
heart.
Yes, you know by heart.
Oh,
we'll ask Chris to put that up on the Facebook page, too.
It's www.waa-isa.org.
All right. So
I refer people to that one all the time.
waa-isa.org. Great. And Chris will put that up on the Facebook page, too. So it seems that there's been a real confluence of conditions this year where, you know, March was just bizarrely warm.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything was, popping out and budding and blooming and everything. And then April felt a lot cooler, but it was actually right about where it should have been. It was just that March was so unusual. But like you said, Laura, it's also been extremely dry. It seems like all of those conditions could really stress plants out.
Oh, yes.
And does that make them more susceptible to the disease then?
We sometimes see that. Really, for a lot of the diseases that I deal with, if we have periods where it's relatively wet for a little bit and we had several days in a row, even though it's been relatively dry, we did have some periods where we had some rain. And when the leaves get wet, a lot of these fungal leaf diseases become more prevalent. I had an apple scab sample. I wasn't expecting to see much apple scab this
already?
Year because, yeah, and it was defoliating a tree. In the La Crosse area. And, you know, I didn't think conditions had been really that great for apple scab, but apparently in that particular area, they had good conditions, a susceptible tree, and it was defoliating.
And Laura, you also mentioned that there's been some frost damage.
Oh, yes.
So how do you tell if a plant has been frost damaged and what does that mean for the
plant? Well, you could come to my yard.
Got a nice little laboratory going.
I actually went out and covered all my plants with sheets and towels and blankets. I ran out of them. But so the stuff that I couldn't cover got frost damage. And what frost damage looks like is the very young developing tips of the branches and the new leaves are either turned black or shriveled up or are wilted. And that's from frost damage. And it's strictly cosmetic. You can prune that out. And the new leaves that the plants have put on are fine. That's classic frost damage injury. And we had, you know, the worst possible scenario with a very warm March, things just popped. Mm-hmm. And then, boom, we got frost, which we normally should have frost in April. And that's what happened. I know some of my, actually a bunch of my lilacs, I thought were okay. They had the flower buds there. They never opened. They were killed by the frost. So it was quite a disappointing year for lilacs.
Let me add something about the lilac situation, because there's actually a bacterial pathogen on that particular plant. And the bacterium is actually an ice nucleator. It actually has a protein in its outer membrane that mimics an ice crystal. So it can actually cause true disease. It can, in fact, cause browning of leaves, lots of yellow haloing. But if you have high enough populations of the bacteria on the leaf surface, it'll actually cause the leaves to freeze at higher temperatures than normal. So you can usually get the leaves down to, what, about 28 before they'll spontaneously freeze. But if you have lots of this bacterium on the leaf, it'll actually cause they'll freeze at a higher temperature.
Oh,
it's
so,
really cool.
So if you're...
Well, it was discovered here at the UW-Madison, and there's actually a practical application. They actually use this organism or derivative of this organism to make snow at ski resorts.
Oh, interesting. So what you're saying when you say it freezes at a higher temperature is that it doesn't actually have to get to 32 or below. It could freeze at, say, 35.
No, because normally what you get is the plants can cool down to below 32 before they'll freeze.
Okay.
But it'll be between that 28 and 32 that they'll start to freeze.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with Brian Huddleston and Laura Jell about plant diseases. And there's lots to talk about.
And trees.
And trees. All kinds of diseases on everything, and trees and woody ornamentals. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us a question or comment at talk@wpr.org. And we do have Tom in Durand on the line, so let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question concerns snow on the mound. My wife talked me into planting this 3 or 4 years ago, and it's beautiful at this time of year in early June, and then by July it starts to wilt away and turn brown.
Yeah, I must say that I'm not a big fan of this particular plant. So this is a disease problem, and I consider it kind of biological control. Sorry to say that. That's my personal opinion. It's kind of a weedy plant, so you're going to have to be careful with that because it will spread a lot. But if you like the plant and can keep it contained in a localized area, this is a fungal disease. It's most likely something called Septoria leaf spot. There's actually a variant of this disease that will cause defoliation on tomato plants. Different specific fungus, but very closely related. And what you need to do is actually some thinning would help, although that's going to be very difficult because this is kind of a ground cover. If you really want to get into it and do fungicide treatments, you could do that, but I hate to recommend that for something like this particular plant. How desperate are you to have this look really, really nice, I guess is my question.
Well, not that. I mean, it's an area that we don't want to mow. So,
sure.
I mean,
yeah.
What I would suggest in the fall is real good fall cleanup, so make sure you're getting rid of any of that old plant material that's died back. and mm-hmm. wait until after the frosts come and it kind of dies back naturally, then get in there and clean out as much of that old plantery as possible. That's kind of a first step for preventing a lot of these fungal foliar diseases. But if we get wet conditions, you're going to see this every year.
And now, what about, Tom, it sounds like you're not that wedded to the snow on the mountain.
No.
Would you be interested in replacing it with a different ground cover if Laura and Brian have some suggestions?
Yeah, I would highly recommend just round up that whole plant and get rid of it. And
be careful if you're going to use Roundup that you don't get it on anything that you really
don't
want.
Don't get it on anything you want. I would plant some. Is it sunny or shady?
Shade and a lot of pine trees in the area.
Okay. Hostas work very well. There are thousands of cultivars of hosta. Myself, I'm kind of a hosta nut. There's so many to choose from. Mixing different types together. There are shade perennials. There's lungwort, pulmonaria is a nice one.
It's a lovely plant.
Yeah, it's very nice.
And I like hostas too, but I like pulmonaria a lot.
Yeah, that's a beautiful plant. There's also a stilbe, which flowers, has very beautiful flowers. There is tirella or foam flower. And those can spread slowly, but they can cover the ground. There is so mm-hmm. many to choose from.
What about something like wild ginger?
Yeah, wild
That's
ginger.
That's a lovely plant,
yep.
too.
Yep, there's Canadian wild ginger as well as European. European is evergreen, whereas our native one is not evergreen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a very shady backyard myself, and I have a lot of bloodroot that I grow.
Yeah.
Try to grow a lot of native plants, so those would be other options as well.
Bloodroot is a spring ephemeral, though.
It is, but the leaves will stay for a while and will cover, so you'd have to mix that with something else, but it's a nice one in the spring. Lovely white flowers.
Mm-hmm. Does that give you some ideas, Tom?
Yeah, too many.
Okay.
We'll stop.
Overwhelm me a little. Bit.
And definitely, if you need further consultation, where are you located?
Bloomer.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I know where that is.
Yeah, definitely you could give Kevin Chesow a call at the mm-hmm. Spooner Ag Research Station. He's kind of your local resource for horticultural information, and he could help you out if you want additional suggestions on what to plant.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Tom. Good luck with that. And let's go right to Kay in Prairie du Sac next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I'm seeing a lot of mature spruce trees, and the only needles they have on them are the new growth on the tips. And I wondered what that disease was and if it's treatable.
Yeah, that's a disease most likely. There are a couple things it could be, but the most common one that I see that will cause that kind of loss of interior needles is something called rhizosphera needle cast. And it's a fungal disease. Oftentimes the infections occur in that newer foliage, but the fungus really doesn't have an effect until the needles age a bit and get farther back into the canopy where there's a lot more moist air, and it will cause the needles to fall off. And unfortunately, by the time you see the disease, there's not a lot that you can do about it. Are these Colorado blue spruce by any chance?
One of them is.
Yeah, that tends to be the most susceptible of the spruces, and I have been quoted as calling that a dog of a tree, even though it's very, very popular. I love Colorado blue spruce, but if you want to see good Colorado blue spruce, go to Colorado.
There's a reason it's Colorado.
Yeah, in our environment, it grows more in the mountains there where it's a little bit drier. And here in our environment where it tends to be a little bit more wet, it gets these sorts of needle diseases. What you can basically do, it becomes an issue of how aesthetically pleasing the tree is. If it's lost so many needles that it looks really ugly to you and you don't like it, your options are kind of to prune off those lower branches, make what Laura calls a lollipop tree, which I know she doesn't like a lot.
No.
Or basically take the tree out and replace it.
Yeah, I'd take the tree out if it looks that bad.
Well, I see these all through, you know, the parks and people's mm-hmm. yards, and apparently mm-hmm. this disease has just spread all over.
It's been around forever, quite frankly. It's the most common disease that I diagnose in my clinic, and that's because spruces are very popular, particular Colorado blue spruce. Well, we do have a fact sheet on this. It's available at my website. I'll give out that website in a bit, and you can take a look for more information, and then if you have questions, you can give me a call.
Is that the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic website?
It is.
We actually have that linked on Facebook,
yep.
pddc.wisc.edu. And Chris Molina, our on-air producer today, also put up the Wisconsin Arborists mm-hmm. link. So lots of great information at the Facebook page. Thanks for that
Thank
call,
you.
Kay. And you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Judith Sears Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us. Well, it's been a very unusual spring, and that's affected many aspects of life, including the plants and trees and ornamentals that we have in our gardens. We're talking about those ornamentals, those plants, those diseases today with Brian Huddleston and Laura Gell. And let's go right back to the phones because we have folks that want to join in. Carrie in Madison has a question. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
What's your question?
We have some oak trees that we didn't get a chance to prune this spring that have a bunch of dead wood on them. They budded out so early, we didn't have a chance to get that off. And so now, especially with those winds we had last night, we have sticks coming down and branches that we're worried about. Do we, because of the oak wilt, do we need to be wait until the fall, or is there a safe way to take those out now?
I would not recommend pruning. If you've got any open wounds that look like they're live tissue, you might want to go out and paint over those, although quite frankly, it's probably too late. The reason you paint over wounds, fresh wounds, is that there are sap beetles that bring in the oak wilt fungus, and those are attracted to those wounds. Unfortunately, there's some information that indicates those insects will visit a wound within 10 minutes of it being wounded. So you need to get that paint on very, very quickly. And you can use a pruning paint or just latex paint that you've got left over from your house. I would not recommend doing just pruning on your own at this point. I would wait until the trees are dormant this fall and winter if you need to do more pruning. It's just safer to do it when the trees are dormant and when the insects aren't around.
Though I do want to mention, if you have hanging limbs that are a hazard and you can't reach them, I would definitely call, again, a certified arborist to do it. They will come out, they'll climb the tree, they'll take out the hanging limbs because you don't want hanging limbs.
Right.
That's a hazard. Mm-hmm. Somebody could get killed. And then they will immediately treat those fresh wounds with the tree paint or wound compound. This is the only time we recommend using that product, either on oaks or elms that absolutely have to be pruned right now during the growing season. Best time to prune is in the dormant season. We don't recommend that tree paint or wound compound for any other species. It actually slows down wound closure. It actually traps moisture. We don't like this product, but the reason why we use it for elms and oaks, elms with Dutch elm disease and with oaks with oak wilt, is to prevent the insects that transfer oak wilt with oaks and Dutch elm disease with elms from transferring the fungus to those fresh open wounds.
Okay. And so what is the definition of a hanging limb? So if it's obviously dead tissue, is that...
Well, if
or something that's imminently going to fall.
Imminently going to fall.
Yeah, if you see something that looks like if it fell, it's going to crush you, your child, your pets, anything else, those would be ones you definitely want to have taken care of right away.
Okay.
But definitely check with the arborist. Certified arborists are usually really good about treating wounds, but I would still bring that up as an issue on an oak tree or an elm tree to make sure that they're going to paint over those any wounds that they create when they make the cuts.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carrie. And you mentioned Dutch elm disease, Laura. I have to say, growing up in Chicago, we lived on a corner lot, and I don't know how old I was, probably maybe 10 or so. We lost every elm tree in the neighborhood. I mean, it went from looking like a mature neighborhood to like a desert.
Like,
I mean, it
was nuclear blast.
It really, even as a kid, and you don't think of, you know, that kids are that into with things, it just felt so... We felt so exposed. There's nothing over us
anymore. That actually, you mentioned that. I grew up my first 4 years of my life in Detroit, and we had the same problem with losing all the elms. And that's probably what got me interested in trees was Dutch elm disease.
Wow. Yeah,
I felt so bad. I was such a young child. I felt so bad for the trees, and I wanted to do something to help them.
Diseases are useful for something, then, right?
They just came through, and one after the other. It was really horrible. Well, thanks for that call, Carrie, and good luck with your tree. Kendra in Milwaukee has a question about peonies, and actually, Chris put a photo up, a similar question from someone, so we actually have a photo of, I think, the same issue on our Facebook page right now. Kendra, what's your question about your peonies?
Hi there. I got these peonies from a friend, inherited them, stuck them in the ground, and have done pretty much nothing with them except fertilize them. And they've done terrific over the last 15 years. But the last couple of years, after they flower, they get these dark brown or black spots on their leaves. And I'm not sure what to do about it. They seem to be surviving.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact have... sprung up some baby plants from seed or however they propagate. So I just wanted to find out if there's anything that we can do to help our peonies look better.
Yeah, the main thing is don't panic. This is not a lethal disease. It's most likely something called botrytis leaf spot. Botrytis, again, is another fungus. And we see it very commonly on peonies with exactly the sort of description that you said, these large black or kind of dark maroon orange or red spots in the leaves. We typically see it more on mature plants, and I think it's because they tend to have a lot of foliage that's very close together, so it, again, traps a lot of moisture. So one of the things that I recommend is actually dividing the plants to have smaller clumps that will get better airflow, that will dry things out more quickly. Actually collecting up the old leaf tissue when after the plants die back in the fall, collecting all that up. That's oftentimes where this fungus will survive, although it's quite common in the environment. And just trying to keep things as dry as possible around the plant. So if you tend to sprinkle, irrigate, use a sprinkler, that's not a good thing. Use a soaker hose and apply that water into the soil rather than onto the leaves. Again, if you get absolutely desperate, there are fungicide treatments, but I usually don't recommend those for this particular disease. It's not serious enough.
And does it stress the plant a lot? Or
I don't see a lot of effects of this particular disease. The plants seem to do quite well, even when they have a fair number of spots on the leaves. So I haven't seen it really reduce flowering or anything else of that sort. I consider it very cosmetic in many ways.
Great. Well, it sounds like a good prognosis for your peonies, Kendra. Yeah. Thanks
and,
for that.
Any suggestions, Laura, on when to divide peonies? When's the best time in your estimation?
I thought it was fall, but I'm not positive on that one.
Okay,
not sure myself on that one either.
And also, I mean, peonies do tend to get kind of out of control and floppy, so it might not be a bad idea aesthetically for that reason either.
Yeah,
to divide
very
them
true.
Up. Great. Well, let's go to Chris in Madison next. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's a two-part question. I have a small fringe tree that is about maybe 6 to 7 feet tall. We've had it for 8 to 10 years, and it's always had very pretty fringy flowers on it, and this year it just looks terrible, and there's a little bit of a few dead pieces on it, I think, but I see cobwebs. I'm not seeing any mites or any other bugs on it, but I'm just wondering, is it one of those things that might have been affected by the early, you know, frost that we had, or the late frost we had, I guess? And the other question is just apple scab, crabapple scab. We had a nice patio tree that has always looked pretty bad by end of June, actually. My husband thinned it out a lot last year, and it looked much better in the spring. But already now it's starting to get some of these brown spots on it. So I just wondered, is there anything else that we can do about that? Just those two questions, please.
Well, let's start with the fringe tree.
Yeah, fringe tree. I love this species. I have two of them in my yard. I wasn't sure. Did you say yours are not flowering?
No, it always has flowered. Oh. This year it just looked, I mean, like the flowers were just limp and dead from the start.
Okay.
Like it was dying.
Okay, one thing, it could be drought. That's the first thing I suspect. But how long have you had it? You said a couple years?
No, probably 8 to 10 years at least.
Okay, then it's established after that long a period, and it shouldn't wilt because fringe tree are pretty drought tolerant. But I would check the soil. Is it too wet? They are very sensitive to wet feet. Has there been, you know, perhaps a water main leak? Somebody left the hose on too long. But usually fringe tree are pretty pest resistant. They even though they're related to ash, they're not one of emerald ash borer's hosts, so they should be fine on that. And I don't know if Brian, do you know of any diseases?
I don't see that particular plant, but you mentioned it's in the same family as ash. So how much wilting are you seeing? Is it just the flowers, or do you see any of the leaves and branches wilting back or dying back as well?
A few branches dying back, and mostly the flowers seem to be wilting. The leaves don't look too bad.
The other thing is verticillium wilt, but I've never seen it on that species, though it is in the family that can get it.
So lilac and ash are both in that family, and they can get verticillium wilt, which is a fungal disease. It comes up through the roots and colonizes the water conducting tissue and blocks it off. The only way I'd be able to tell for certain if that's what it is would be if you got a sample into my clinic. We'd have to actually try to extract the fungus from tissue, and we'd need dying branches or wilting branches to do that.
Now, what Chris is describing, is this something that could be related to what you were saying about lilacs? A lot of the lilacs didn't bloom, and just with the weird temperatures and things like that?
Well, with fringe tree, they're one of the very last things to bloom in spring. They usually bloom about the end of May. Mine are in bloom right now, as well as at the Arboretum. So they are a little bit earlier this year, but they pretty much escaped frost injury because they don't even leaf out until this time of year. Everybody thinks they're dead, and then all of a sudden, boom, it leaves out in flowers. So I don't suspect frost injury at all.
Okay.
And then your other question was about apple scab.
Yeah. My question with that is, how emotionally attached are you to your crab apple tree?
Terribly, because it really makes our patio. It shades the patio. It's just perfect.
Yeah, that's always the first question I ask when you have a crab apple that's really susceptible to apple scab. Because if you're not attached to it, then I recommend removing the current tree and putting in a newer variety that has resistance. If you really like this tree and want to keep it, your options are one of the things you've already done, which is to thin. And what that tends to do is provide better airflow, quickens drying of leaves when they get wet, and makes the environment less favorable for the disease. If you really need to have that tree look nice through the summer, then pretty much your only other option, well, you need to do good fall cleanup. So remove any of the leaves that have come off the tree in the fall, because that's where the fungus overwinters. But your other option is really fungicide sprays. And you're really talking about starting those when the tree first leaves out in the spring. And then you're talking about applications every 7 to 14 days, oftentimes through much of the growing season. And most homeowners aren't really interested in doing that. But that's certainly an option.
Okay. All right.
And again, if you're interested in knowing about products, if you go to my website in the publication section, we do have a fact sheet on scab. And there is a list of active ingredients that you should be able to find on the homeowner market that you can use for treating for that disease. The real critical thing, though, is early application, right as the leaves are first starting to come out, regular routine of applications, and good coverage of the leaves, so you get both the upper and lower surface of the leaves with the product. And you do have to be careful. This is just an ornamental, not an edible apple?
Correct.
Okay. You do have to be careful with that list of products that I have. Some are labeled for ornamental, some are labeled for edible apples. You just need to read the label of the product that you select to make sure it's labeled for an ornamental use.
Okay. We learned on your show, I think last year, about the importance of thinning the tree, and that did make a big difference.
Yes.
It was 2 years ago, but in the spring after we thinned it, it made a huge difference. But now, you know, it's starting up again. So.
And thinning, you may want to go revisit the thinning idea, because it may have grown enough new foliage and new branches to tighten up that canopy again, and you want to open it up to get better airflow.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Great. Thanks for that call, Chris. And let's go to Alan next in Wild Rose. Hi, Alan.
Howdy.
What's your question?
Actually, I have a couple, and it all involves fruit trees. I have four apples, a greening, a Macintosh, a white French, and another French apple, I can't remember that, and a plum tree. Three of my apples have what my parents and grandparents call sun scald, to the point where it's actually the bark is peeling off the main part of the trunk, and it's exposing stuff the size of the palm of my hand. What can I do about that?
Oftentimes these sorts of problems are established, can be an issue from, you know, stress related. And if the trees are planted too deeply initially, that's oftentimes a stress that will predispose them to something like sun scald. Anything you can do to shade that part of the trunk that's scalding might help you a little bit. Laura, any suggestions you have for, you know, don't deal with fruit trees, but other types of trees get this sort of problem.
Yeah. First question I have is, how old are these trees?
About 15 years.
Okay. So they've been in the ground a long time.
Yes, they have been.
All right. So.
In about the last 3 years.
Okay. One thing I would look at is at the base of your plant.
Okay.
And I would, first of all, do not ever have bark or any type of mulch touching the base of the tree.
There isn't. I've got it wrapped in plastic netting and about 3 inches distance to keep the rabbits out of it in the winter.
Okay, good. I would look for damage at the base of the tree. And the reason why I'm asking that is sometimes when you have damage at the base of the tree that causes internal cracks, you don't see them. But on the outside of the tree, you may see some bark injury. And what happens is that internal crack travels up the trunk of the tree. It can cause what's called frost crack. And sometimes that's due to too deep of planting. The root flare needs to be right at that soil line. The root's not exposed, but the flare right at the soil line. And unfortunately, a lot of times when trees come bald and burlapped, Sometimes that root flare is buried 2, 4, sometimes up to 6 inches or more deep in that root ball. And when we bury that trunk tissue below the ground, it starts to decay. Okay? And when that trunk tissue starts to decay, it can cause injury to move up the trunk of the tree. Also, root injury can cause some bark damage. You totally think, well, it's due to the sun, but it's actually due to some other underlying problem. And the intense heat of the sun can exacerbate the problem, but typically it had started with some type of root injury, planting too deep, or some animal gnawing on the base of the plant.
Yeah, maybe some girdling roots, too, if they've been planting too. Those are roots that grow around the trunk, and that can stress the tree as well.
The trees are 20 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't believe, and there is nothing between them except, I've got them espaliered.
Okay.
So there's some posts that are being running on copper wire.
One question I have is when you're mowing.
Yes.
Could perhaps the mower or weed whacker got too close to the trunk?
No. This I know because I do it. So.
Okay.
Yeah, that can be. We see that oftentimes in ornamental trees where people we get lawnmower, what we call lawnmower injury,
and lawnmower blight.
Yeah, and that will cause these sorts of things. At this point, my suggestion would be to basically make sure that the trees, you want to basically maximize their growing conditions and make sure they're getting watered properly. And also, you know, you may want to take a soil test, make sure that their fertility is optimal, and just try to get them to grow.
You've had a huge crop of apples for the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
And that may be a function of it, not the tree not doing particularly well, because oftentimes the
bumper
trees are are stimulated to flower when they're stressed.
It's really put its energy into them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of what to do about the bark coming off, there really isn't anything you can do. I would take, you know, if it's loose, take it off. The tree will need to close that wound over, and there's really nothing you can do except water the tree, provide cultural conditions favorable for growth.
Well, thanks for that call, Alan, and good luck with those apples. We had a question on Facebook from Anne. She says, my queen of the prairie plants were beautiful and prolific for many years, but last year and now again this year, the leaves are curling and turning gray, and the plant is dying back before blooming. Could this be a fungus or mildew, and is there anything I can do about it?
My suspicion on queen of the prairie, speaking from experience from my own parents, they have queen of the prairie, and they have really serious problems with powdery mildew and the kind of dusky sort of discoloration.
That gray color that she's talking about.
That she's talking about sounds very similar to what I would expect. If you have a hand lens and can look at the leaves and you see a lot of fuzzy growth, it's probably powdery mildew. And again, we've seen powdery mildews very, very early this year. Powdery mildews tend to be more prevalent when we have high humidity, and that can be a function of how closely packed plants are in a garden. So thinning to open up airflow, to remove moisture can be helpful. And you may want to grow something else if you are consistently having problems, because this particular plant, I've heard a lot of problems with powdery mildews on this particular host. The other thing that my parents started doing last year, which is something that we recommend in general, is kind of an easy fungicide treatment for powdery mildews, is there's some research out of Cornell University where they use a mix of baking soda and a lightweight horticultural oil in water, and you spray it as a preventative treatment, so before you see symptoms early in the season. And if you get good coverage, a lot of folks have had good success using that. It's a very low-impact sort of pesticide or fungicide, and can be very easily mixed up. You do have to be careful with the oil, that you use a really lightweight oil. Mm. And don't use something like dormant oil. Some people have tried motor oil. That doesn't work. Way too heavy. You want a very lightweight horticultural oil. There's a brand, and there may be other ones that you can use, but the one I've been able to refer folks to, because it seems to be easy to find, is something called Safeticide, SAF-T-SIDE. It's readily available to order off the internet, and I ordered some of that for my parents, and they tried it last year, and they were happy with the success. And again, there is some research that indicates that this can be a good treatment. And it's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda, and then 3 tablespoons of the lightweight horticultural oil in a gallon of water.
Okay.
And some people want to use kitchen oils, and if you're going to do that, I would suggest trying canola oil, because there's some research that indicates that canola oil on its own can provide powdery mildew control. I would pretest basically any of these mixtures before you apply it to the entire plant. Do a couple of leaves, wait for 24 to 48 hours to see if you see any burn symptoms, so any browning of the foliage. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the oils can cause burn symptoms.
Well, and that's interesting that you just mentioned using canola, because if I'm remembering correctly, rosemary is really susceptible mm-hmm. to powdery mildew.
Right.
And of course, if you're planning on using rosemary for cooking, you don't want to put anything on it that you don't want to ingest eventually.
Sure.
So it sounds like that would be a pretty safe way if you're...
Yeah, you could try that with canola oil, baking soda. You could try this mixture on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. It's Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and just want to let you know a couple things coming up on Monday. We will be talking about birds, as we often do on holidays. We will be talking with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. They'll be joining us at 11 on Monday to talk about spring migration and much more. And also at 6 o'clock on Monday morning on the Joy Cardine Show, they will be doing a general garden discussion with Mark Conlock from the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. It's the largest in the state, and they'll be able to answer pretty much any of your gardening questions. So if you're up and at 'em early on Monday morning, tune into the Joy Gardening Show for more garden talk. And here we are talking gardens and woody ornamentals and trees and, yes, diseases with Brian Huddleston and Laura Gell. They join us a few times a year to talk about these things. And I have to say, working with Larry on Garden Talk, I really didn't know there were so many diseases out there. It's kind of scared me. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to manage out there.
I jokingly tell people when I give talks that I need to have grief counselors in the back of the room, because I paint such a really horrible picture of what's out there. But
and not all
of
our listeners might know that you also go by Dr. Death.
Yeah, that's my radio handle. And I've done radio in Milwaukee as well as here on the program. And that was my radio handle. And that kind of tickles my fancy. So, but, you know, most of the time our plants are relatively healthy. It's mm-hmm. just sometimes we have issues with diseases. And oftentimes we've talked about several of the diseases that are cosmetic. You know, mm-hmm. you see the symptoms,
right.
but in terms of affecting the overall health. Yeah, basically that's right.
And I definitely want to get some ideas about some good, you know, woody ornamentals, trees, plants that are disease resistant, because it seems like there are probably some better options for mm-hmm. people. It's just knowing, well, obviously sometimes you move into somewhere and there are already these established plants, but if you're actually adding something, you mentioned natives. Are natives often a good choice?
Yeah. One of my very favorite alternatives to crabapple is our native serviceberry,
mm-hmm.
amelanchier. Serviceberry has delicious fruit that you can eat. Wait till it turns very dark purple, then it's sweet. Otherwise, it's not very good.
If the birds don't get it first.
If the exactly, birds don't get it first, I know. I've one in my yard, and I'm just waiting until it turns purple, because I've made muffins out of it,
I used to just throw it on cereal. And
yeah,
great.
It's delicious. Amelanchier, there's several different types. I am a big fan of the hybrid, which is apple serviceberry, and it's Amelanchier grandiflora. And that one is a hybrid of our two native species, and it has better disease resistance and also better flowering and fruiting than the other species alone. And that usually ripens in June, the fruit. So it's an early riper, mm-hmm. so it's delicious. There are many other plants. There's hawthorns, but those can get rust. Nothing is immune to mm-hmm. pests. But I think a really nice alternative, if you want that fruit, is serviceberry.
Yeah. In my mind, diversity is really important, because
yes.
we tend to see more problems with diseases when people plant lots and lots of the same thing.
Right.
The more you have, it's just like people. The more crowded we are, the more likely we're going to pass things around. And the mm-hmm. same thing occurs with plant diseases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look at what your neighbors have.
Don't plant something different.
Plant something different.
Yeah.
No matter how lovely it looks.
And I would really recommend, if you're building a new home, have a real long discussion with the builder about what they are going to put in the landscape, because mm-hmm. I have seen the worst possible trees go in.
Yep.
I had someone where they planted a Colorado blue spruce, which I would never recommend. They planted a green ash, which I would never recommend. And they planted a crabapple tree, and I predicted to the homeowner, I'm betting by next summer it will be defoliated, and sure enough it was. So it was a variety that was susceptible to apple scab.
Wow.
So you need to make sure that when they're putting in new trees in a landscape that they are materials that are appropriate and are likely to be sustainable in the landscape.
Well, and especially when you're talking about trees. I mean, it's one thing, you know, to get rid of the ground cover that's not doing well or right. yank out a peony or something. But when you're talking about trees, it seems like a little research and planning mm-hmm. ahead of time when you're mm-hmm. probably going to have that, when that tree's probably going to be there long after you yeah. are not anymore,
right.
yeah. makes a lot of sense.
In terms of some of other great natives, if you have good soil, I highly recommend sugar maple. I love sugar maples. Fall Fiesta is a very nice selection of sugar maple. It has thicker leaves that are less susceptible to leaf tatter, as well as its thicker cuticle. It's a little bit more drought tolerant. Sugar maples do need good moisture, but not wet. Chinkapin oak is another wonderful native shade tree. I have one in my yard, and it's just a fantastic underutilized native oak tree that actually likes higher pH. So instead of planting white oak or red oak that really does need a more acidic soil, chinkapin oak does just fine in high pH.
Don't plant a pin oak, please.
Yeah, don't plant a pin oak unless your soil is below 6.5 pH.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones and Lois in Eau Claire. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I have a question regarding a William Baffin climbing rose.
Yes, familiar with it.
Okay. It's about 9 years old. It's done beautifully. Survives the winter fine. It survived this winter, which was mild here. Then it leafed out, and I've got buds on it. But the blossoms this year are looking a little smaller and slightly curled. The blossoms might have been starting at the when it was warm, and then when we had some frost, I don't know if that affected them.
It could, but
the rest of the canes and foliage looks the same. Good.
Okay, when's the last time you fertilized it?
This year,
you did. What did you use?
The exact name I don't know, but it was a special rose, you know, for four roses.
Okay, and you followed the directions in terms of rate?
Yes.
Okay. Because that's one thing that popped in my mind, because with roses, sometimes as they get older, the flowers may not be as showy. It might need a boost of fertilizer.
Okay.
The next thing, water.
Yes.
Is the next thing. Third thing, when's the last time you've pruned it?
Well, I did some pruning this spring.
Okay.
But maybe not enough.
Well, sometimes with climbing roses, and they might need a little bit of rejuvenation over time if it's a very old rose and it doesn't produce real well. Obviously, it sets its flower buds in early spring for summer bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And if you prune it in early spring, that you are going to be removing some of your summer display of flowers. However, you can wait until after it's done flowering and thin it out some, and that will encourage more shoots. Then next year, hopefully those new shoots will produce more flowers.
Cut back way to the ground?
No, not all the way back to the ground. I would do some selective thinning of some of the branches.
Okay.
Open it up more. It might be starting to shade itself.
Okay.
Also, do you have any trees overhead that are starting to shade it?
No. It's
okay.
White house, southwest exposure, so it has great sun.
Yeah, okay, that's what they need.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks
for
that call, Lois. And Carol in Appleton is next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have some kind of orange spots that are appearing on leaves and different things in the yard, and they have a certain depth to them, like they're either a fungus or they're some kind of insect eggs. I'm not sure what it is, but it's very orange, and they have some height to them when you look up close. They almost look like little vertical cylinders all packed together or something.
Yeah.
Oh, Brian is nodding knowingly.
What's the host, or what sort of plants are you seeing this on?
Well, we got some invasive tree in our yard.
A buckthorn. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And what else are you seeing it on?
Well, it seems to get on not much else, but occasionally it'll like get into any kind of leaf on the ground. I've got a yard that's got a lot of wild violets in it, and they seem to end up on that a little bit. But I think it's more transfer if a leaf falls off, and then it kind of
the orange.
I don't know if I'm worried whether it'll spread to anything.
Yeah, I'm suspecting what you're seeing is this is probably rust. What you're probably seeing it on, since you said it was invasive, is buckthorn, because that's one of the ways actually that if I'm not sure whether a little tree is buckthorn, I will look for the rust to identify it.
Because it's that common.
It's that common, and it can help me with the identification. The orange that you're seeing that's transferring from the other plants is probably because this fungus is producing a lot of powdery spores, and it's just that powder that's getting off and then ending up on other plants. That particular plant, if it is truly buckthorn, is one that you want to get rid of because it's invasive and it can crowd out other more important plants in your landscape. The interesting thing about this particular rust is that it's a two-host rust. It's what's called an alternating rust. So it spends parts of its life cycle on buckthorn. The other host for this, as it turns out, is turf grass. So you may start to see really, really orange sporulation, powdery material that starts to form on your grass, particularly in shadier areas. And if you do, that's the alternate phase of the disease. So one of the reasons why you want to get rid of the buckthorn is, one, it's invasive. Two, it's the alternate host for this rust. So if you don't want it on your grass, you get rid of the buckthorn. And then if you're near any agricultural land, the other reason you want to get rid of buckthorn is it's an overwintering host for soybean aphids, which is a major insect pest on soybean.
So, Carol, it sounds like getting rid of the buckthorn will do a lot, not only getting rid of the rust, but protecting a lot of other things, too.
And Laura has an excellent publication on buckthorn and how to control that. So you want to tell them a little bit more about
that? Yeah, it's a threefold brochure, but you can download it off the web, off the Urban Horticulture Team's website.
And that one is hort.uwex.edu.
Great. All right. Well, good luck with that, Carol. And Jeanette in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I had an ivy geranium plant in my garden, and when I moved into a condo unit, I transplanted it into a pot. And for 2 years, it seemed to do well. But the last 2 years, the edges of the leaves turned brown and curl up. I've been removing the leaves. I've repotted the soil. I pruned the whole plant down to almost the bottom or the top of the soil. And I just wonder if I should give up, because I don't know why the leaves turn brown around the edges.
Yeah, you just may be pressing the lifespan of the plant, quite frankly, because normally we grow ivy geraniums as an annual in this area. So I applaud you for trying to maintain it for a long period of time, but it may be to the point where you want to replace it, get a new one. I think that might be easier than trying to recuperate this particular plant. One thing I would worry about, there is a bacterial disease that we've been seeing some of in the state. Sometimes we see it occur on older plants that have been maintained for a period of time. The name of the disease is bacterial blight, and it just seems to be associated with plants. This year we had a problem with a supplier of geraniums to greenhouses that had a contamination problem, and so we saw it show up around the state. If it's that particular problem, this would be something where, again, you'd want to get rid of the plants, and then anything that's come into contact with those plants, pots, surfaces, you want to decontaminate. With pots, you can wash them and then soak them in a 10% bleach solution for about 20 to 30 minutes. For surfaces, I would recommend 70% alcohol, so rubbing alcohol or the spray disinfectants typically work quite well for that. And you just want to try to eliminate the bacterium so that if you bring in another geranium, you don't recontaminate that plant.
And is that particular blight likely to go on to other types of plants too, or is it mainly geraniums?
It's pretty specific to geraniums. It will go to ivy geraniums and zonal geraniums, which are the typical potted ones that you see. It will also go to some perennial geraniums. I actually had a sample of that, and I'd never seen it on that particular host before that came in this spring. So you'd have to be careful of spread to other geranium-like plants, but it won't go to other types of ornamentals. It's specific to things in the geranium family.
And because I'm not familiar with it, ivy geranium, to me, that sounds like it might be kind of more of a trailing geranium.
Yeah, it's commonly used in hanging baskets or window boxes, and it's a full sun annual It's really thick leaves. Okay. Compared to regular geraniums.
Okay, great. Thanks for that call, Jeanette. And Larry on the Facebook page said, leaves on my clematis are turning yellow, not dropping off, just turning yellow. Someone suggested 1 tablespoon of Epsom salts per every quart of water. What do you recommend?
I would be inclined to get a soil test just to find out where your fertility and your soil pH would be, because yellowing, depending upon the pattern of yellowing, can indicate a pH issue that will lock up nutrients in the soil so the plants can't take them up. And I routinely recommend that gardeners about every 3 to 5 years do a soil test just so they have baseline information on what their fertility is. And the Soil and Plant Analysis Lab, which is a facility of UW Extension, there's a place in Verona, also one in Marshfield, can provide information. On how to collect a sample, and we'll do the analysis for you. And then based on that, you can fertilize properly.
Yeah, I'd be real careful with Epsom salts per every quart of water. That sounds like a very high rate. I could be wrong, but getting the soil test on, because Epsom salts is magnesium sulfate, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember. I was racking my brain exactly what's in that.
And applying too much can actually cause a deficiency of another nutrient like calcium. I also, with yellowing, if this is a newly planted clematis, it could be a water issue.
Hmm. And you were saying that we've been having quite a dry spring.
At least in the southern part of the state, it is dry.
And sometimes if it's lower leaves that are yellow, it can be a nitrogen deficiency as well, because that tends to be mobile and tends to get moved around on the plants if the plants are deficient. So I really suggest probably both a sample and a soil sample. Get that analyzed.
Great. And I just want to draw people's attention to the Facebook page. Phil emailed in a photo that looks like an albino milkweed. And I don't think it actually fits in with what we're talking
about.
It's
very cool, though.
But it's a very cool picture. So you'll want to check that out. And his question is, this milkweed is growing in the garden. Is there albinism in plants? And I'm guessing
probably is. It's a shoot that produces only white leaves. And it cannot survive on its own because there's no chlorophyll. And in terms of the question, will the monarch caterpillars be a different color? I highly doubt it.
Well, Phil will have to let us know that.
Yeah.
You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Well, if you're like me, just keeping up with the care of a healthy garden can be a big commitment and can be hard to get around to. And when disease strikes our plants, then it can really be hard to deal with and keep up with. I'm Judith Sears Poisson today, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk. And we're lucky to have two experts here to help us figure out what might be going on in our gardens, to treat any problems we might discover, and also to help us make good choices about caring for our woody ornamentals, our trees, and other plants. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. Welcome back, Brian.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Laura Jell is a professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Thanks for joining us again today, Laura.
Good to be here.
So, Laura, actually, let's just define woody ornamentals. What are they? What falls into that category?
Trees, shrubs, evergreens, some ground covers, some vines, anything that has secondary growth with a woody stem.
Okay. So thinking of things that are not just kind of like the ephemerals you were talking about, or just leaves,
not herbaceous perennials that die back to the ground. With woodies, they don't.
Something
die back.
Sticks around.
Yes, hopefully.
Great. Well, we have a lot of people online that would like to join in, so let's go right back to the phone. Alan Kakauna has a question. Hi, Al. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Great show. I had one comment, one question. The comment was, I've got two flowering crab apple trees in my yard that are probably 25 years old. And this year, I don't know if it's because of the goofy spring we had, but we had blossoms on those trees. They were just beautiful for, I bet you, a month this year. I've never seen that before. Usually they blossom, and then we get a rainstorm or a windstorm, and all the blossoms are gone, and then they just, they're just green. But this year they were just fantastic. But the question I had was, I planted an apple tree up at my cabin last year, and I had a buddy tell me that if I don't plant some other apple trees close to it, that one won't do very well because they have to cross-pollinate.
Yes, that's true.
So I got another apple tree, and I just want to know, does it matter if they're the same variety or can they be different varieties, and how far apart should I plant them, and can I do to, to like fertilize them? The one I got last year was a bare root apple tree that my wife got from one of the catalogs, and I planted it. It was only about 10 inches tall last year, and I put a wire cage around it to protect it from the deer.
Mm-hmm.
And it grew probably, I'd say, 4 feet in a year. That one's doing great. But I got another one that's about the same size as the one I had got last year, and I want to plant it. And actually, I want to create an area to attract, you know, wildlife, deer and turkeys and stuff like that. But I was just wondering how I should do it to get to be successful.
Great. Let's get the opinion of Laura and Brian.
Yeah, I was going to say the main thing that I can think of, if since you need the cross-pollination, you need varieties that are blooming at about the same time of the year. And, you know, I can't speak to the particular varieties that you have, but that would be one of the things I would check on.
Yeah, typically they recommend different varieties to cross-pollinate. I'm not sure if the same cultivar would pollinate the same cultivar. They are bee pollinated, and I'm not sure about that. I don't deal with fruit mm-hmm. trees.
Mm-hmm.
In regards to, I'm trying to think what your question was.
Fertilizing and stuff like that.
Oh, fertilizing. With apples, there are some extension publications out there on how to grow apple trees. And if you go to the
Learning Store
mm-hmm. website, you can download some of the publications on fruit trees. And there is one on apples. And it tells you which ones pollinate which and how to fertilize and all that.
Yeah, there's a great multi-page publication. It's about $4 or $5. Mm-hmm. I think it's well worth the price on growing apples in Wisconsin, and that's one that I oftentimes recommend to folks. Actually buy that one. It's a nice publication. It's got tons of information on growing apples.
Right. That's the UW Extension Learning Store, and they have, I think, a publication on just about anything you might be looking for. So they have great information. Thanks for that call, Al. And Wendy emailed, I have a 50-year-old birch tree, and at the base of the trunk, there are two areas about 3 by 3 inches that look like sores that are deep reddish brown. It almost looks like it's bleeding. It looks like a firecracker was lit there, but I doubt if that's what happened. A lawnmower has definitely not hit it. I hope I am not losing my birch clump. What do you think?
Okay. Usually those type of wounds I associate with borers, but those are higher up in the tree, usually not at the base of the tree. I'm not sure if there was some animal chewing on the bark. Brian?
Yeah, I would worry a little bit at that point about some sort of root colonizing fungus of some kind, root rot, that would move up into the lower trunk of the tree. It's hard to tell based on the description exactly what might be going on with mm-hmm. that. If it is something like that, it's going to be very difficult to deal with. I would simply, from a disease standpoint, monitor to see whether those areas expand or not.
Mm. And is that something where an arborist could take a look?
Yes,
okay. Definitely.
So again, looking at that list of certified arborists. Yeah. Because, yeah, especially if it's something systemic like that, it's probably better to know sooner rather than later,
yeah. Right?
Typically, those types, when you described it, it sounded like bronze birch borer, but that occurs higher up in the tree.
Not so low down to the ground.
No, not at the base, typically.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. And there was also a photo put on our Facebook page from Margaret. This looks really interesting. It says, can your guests please tell me what this could be? This covered the soil on a plant that I had outside all last summer. It just popped up a few weeks ago, and I've been pulling it out each time it comes up. Should I keep pulling it up, or does it need to be treated with a fungicide? And for people that aren't able to look at the Facebook page right now, it's little yellowish kind of
fingers.
Almost capsule-shaped things that look almost like mushrooms.
Yeah, they look like little fingers, and I think they are the initials of mushrooms. I suspect those will eventually form caps of some kind or another. It maybe not, but it does look fungal. It wouldn't be anything that you would treat with a fungicide. Most of the fungicides would not probably control that sort of organism anyway. I think the best thing, because it sounds like it's more of a cosmetic issue, mm-hmm. is just to pull them up when you see them.
And what about if she decided to repot that plant? Would she be able to get rid of that, or is it just going to...
Probably not.
Well, she could wash the soil off the roots and get totally new soil, but there's spores.
Yeah, might still pop up.
Okay. Well, just think of it, Margaret, instead of thinking of it as a potted plant, think of it as a mushroom factory.
I think it's pretty cool.
It's kind of cool. You get rid of that other plant so it's not taking the nutrients away from your mushrooms. Well, let's go to David in Whitefish Bay next. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a white, I think, French lilac that's probably 8-10 years ago. In the leaves, I noticed sort of just almost a geographic or a area where it turns brown, just a square, and usually on one side of the leaf. It doesn't cross the midline. I don't know, it didn't flower that well this year, but these brown spots seem to be earlier this year.
Yeah, are you seeing a lot of yellow halos around those brown areas?
No. Okay. Well, no, it's just right brown right up to the edge.
Okay. One thing I do see on lilacs is a disease called bacterial blight, and we discussed this a little bit earlier, and that is a bacterial problem. It occurs on lilacs quite commonly. There's not a lot you can do for it. Sometimes it will take the tips of the branches out and prune those out. I would prune down probably 8 or 10 inches below where you see the brown tissue. If it's just on some of the leaves, I wouldn't be overly concerned about it. There could be some frost injury, I suppose, on those leaves as well. Sometimes that'll cause browning. Laura, you may want to comment on he mentioned lack of blooming.
One thing, lack of blooming with the lilacs, do you have any shade that's shading the plant?
Yeah, I guess it was under an ash tree.
Yeah.
The village has just cut it down. So.
Oh, okay. Then flowering should improve because lilacs absolutely must have full sun or their flower production is lousy.
Okay.
And also with lilacs, as they get old, you need to do renewal pruning, and that's removing the largest diameter branches, about a third of them, each year back to the base of the plant or every couple years, actually, with lilacs. And what that does is that encourages new suckers to come up on the French lilacs, and they will bloom in a couple years. When lilac branches get more than, 5-6 years old, the flower production actually starts to decline, and the larger diameter branches are prone to lilac borer infestations.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, good luck with that. And Nancy in Grafton also has a lilac question, so let's go there. Hi, Nancy.
Back to the lilacs again.
That's fine.
Okay, I had two lilac bushes. Both of them had got the same kind of a fungus on the lilac branches, and it was a kind of a gray scale, and they're done. I mean, one I had to get rid of, and the other one we cut way back, but what is going on? And the other question is about some bluebells that are in my garden, and there's a flower bark garden. These things have overtaken everything. We've tried to pull them, rototill them. They just keep coming up. Is there any kind of spray? I don't want them. And is there any kind of thing that I can do to get rid of those?
Well, you can bring them to my yard.
You won't want them because you can't get rid of them.
Well, they're a native. They're a wonderful native, and they're a spring ephemeral. They come up, they flower, and then they disappear.
Well, you just can't get rid of them. I mean, they've taken over the tulips, everything, roses. Everything is just all covered with those gosh darn kind of bluebell things. They got heart-shaped leaves, and they got a little bell-shaped flower that comes underneath the leaf.
And actually, I think Brian might have an idea of
I think you're probably dealing with creeping bellflower, which is a really nasty,
different.
Invasive weed.
Yeah. The other ones are actually, they don't spread that often, and they just die back. So
I have this one in my yard along with a lot of other invasive weeds as well.
What did you call it again?
It's called creeping bellflower. And it has a bluebell-like flower, but it has that heart shape that makes a little spike of flowers. It's quite pretty, but it just spreads all over the place. I don't necessarily remember the control because I'm not a weed expert. If you email me, though, I can forward your information on to one of our weed experts, and we'll get some answers for you on how to control that.
Well, and also, if you didn't hear earlier, we mentioned that at 6 o'clock on Monday morning, Joy Cardine is going to be talking about gardening, and she's going to have the horticulture director from the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and he might have some advice for that, too, if you're up bright and early on Monday morning. But let's also talk about the issues with the lilacs that you were talking about.
Yeah, the stuff that you're seeing is it looked like it's kind of a little bit leafy.
No, it's just like a gray, like a scale on it.
And is it small and defined, or is it kind of amorphous? It grows in patches on the branch.
It's in patches all the way.
Maybe lichens. Laura suggested lichens, and that could very well be. And those aren't anything to get overly excited about. They tend to grow in areas where there's a fair amount of moisture, and they just like to grow on things. It's a combination of a fungus and an alga, and they live symbiotically. And we'll see those in a variety of environments, but they do like moist conditions many times. You actually want a lot of lichens. The more different types of lichens that you see, typically that's an indication of better air quality. So that's something you don't need to worry about.
I kind of liken it.
Yeah.
All right.
That's well, bad. We've really got bad.
We've gotten our bad joke out for the day. Took us a while, but we got there.
I do want to quickly mention about lilac scale. If you're still not sure, you can always send us a photo because lilacs are susceptible to oyster shell scale.
Okay.
I can give out my email if
sure. Why don't you write?
Yeah, it's B as in boy, D as in David, H as in Harry at plantpath, PlantPath. .wisc.edu. And definitely, if you have a question while we're off the air, give me a shout.
Great. Thanks for that call. And Mary in Lebanon has a question. Mary.
Hi. Yeah. I would like better luck with my tomatoes, so I want to start early with preparing for blight because obviously I've had issues with it.
Sure.
And so, I know you're supposed to look for blight-resistant plants, which I'm making an effort to do, but I'm figuring with the weather this year and the diseases, I'm going to have fun, so I might as well start early.
Sure. The blight that you're talking about, is this the one that kind of defoliates the plants from the bottom up? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and well, last year I did everything you should possibly do, and then we had a bad storm when we were gone on a trip, and my ground covering got blown away, and so I got soil on the plants, and so it was basically done for right away, you know.
Sure.
But I've had the late blight that has really messed up things too. So, and I do the rotation. I mean,
okay.
And all that kind of stuff.
So. Yeah, you mentioned getting resistant varieties. That isn't my first suggestion because oftentimes the resistant varieties don't have fruits that taste particularly good. And that we have to distinguish between these common sorts of blights, which we're talking about. It's Septoria leaf spot and early blight are the two most common ones. And then there's late blight, which is a much more serious disease. But it sounds like you're dealing with the common ones that defoliate from the bottom up. So good fall cleanup is the first thing. So remove any of the old plant debris that you possibly can from last year's tomatoes and potatoes. Because one of the pathogens, one of the fungi, will go to both hosts. When you go in this year, do move your tomatoes to a new location in the yard or in your garden. Plant these plants as far apart as you possibly can. You really don't want any of the foliage touching when those plants grow to full size. Mulch over the area where you have your tomatoes planted with about an inch of mulch would be fine. I would also go back to the area where you had tomatoes and potatoes last year and mulch over that area because you want to prevent spore movement out of the soil, actually little bits of old tomato debris in the soil that can blow or splash up onto your new plants. You may want to prune up some of the branches from the bottom to increase airflow or even thin some of the branches out of the shrubs. You want to basically, if the leaves get wet, you want them to dry quickly. If you're watering, do not use a sprinkler. Use a soaker hose to apply the water into the soil. You want to keep those leaves as dry as you possibly can. You can go for the resistant varieties, but we've talked about the problems there. There are fungicide treatments, but at that point, I usually tell folks, if you've got to do that, go to your local farmer's market and buy some tomatoes there.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that call, Mary. And let's go to Jeff in Neenah next. Hi, Jeff.
Thank you. I have a hedge around our patio. It's an alpine currant. I've had it for about, 17 or 18 years. But every spring, I get some die-off of branches that die, and I have to cut those out. I do try to spray it before it leaves in the spring with some sort of an oil space spray, but it doesn't seem to be taking care of it completely.
Yeah, it's hard for me to comment on what exactly that might be. That would be something where I'd really need to see a sample in my clinic to tell you for certain what it is. The oil that you're using is, in my mind, is primarily going to control insect pests, if there are any. Usually those don't work as well, in my mind, for diseases. It's probably a fungal leaf disease of some kind that's causing some browning and leaf loss, but at this point I can't really say much more than that.
Yeah, I've seen alpine currants get anthracnose.
Yeah, they also get a lot of powdery mildew sometimes as well, but without, if you're really interested in finding out what it is, that would be where I would suggest get a sample in. We do charge for a service, but for $20 we can probably figure out what you're dealing with.
Is it too late to bring a branch in now?
No, if you're seeing, particularly if you're seeing symptoms right now, where I can see what you're seeing, you could definitely get a sample in.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for that call. And Brian, actually, why don't you tell people how to send in a sample? How much do you need? How fresh does it need
to be? Yeah, more is always better. If you can send me the whole plant, I always tell folks that's best.
Probably not a whole tree.
Well, we have had whole trees. I had an 18-foot crab apple come in one time, roots and all. We don't suggest that. Basically, if you can get us a representation of what you're seeing in terms of what you think is wrong with the plant, that's helpful. More is always better because the more symptoms we can see, the more we're likely to find out what we need. We do have instructions on my website. It gives details on how to collect samples, how to mail them in. You can always solicit help from your county extension office. The county agents there know about, I'm actually a support lab for the County Extension Service here in the state, and they are used to sending in samples so they can help you get materials as well and get it into me, or you can mail it directly either way.
Great. Thanks for the call. And let's get to Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. I am just loving this show. It's just amazing. You guys are my heroes, and I think you're geniuses. I have a very keen affection for trees, and at the edge of Brown Deer Park near a bike trail, there's these trees that must be at least 40 years old. And I think it's rust, but I'm not sure. And I've asked several people that are, you know, in the horticulture business. But I don't think anybody really cares, but I do. So I'm desperate to identify this and, like, go to who I need to get these trees saved. Because it seems to be spreading and it's very prevalent. And I'm looking across the street now from where I am in Brown Deer. I see some on my neighbor's trees also.
Do you have any idea what kind of trees they are?
I think it's I've tried to identify. I think it's a Swiss stone, but I'm looking right now in
Swiss
my Trees of North America. It's like a Phillips book. It's an older one. And it's not a white pine. It's not a spruce, which I'm not fond of. I'm pretty sure.
Some spruces are nice, but I understand your philosophy there.
I highlighted you a long time ago, a roller pine or Swiss stone pine.
Yeah. I'm wondering whether it might be Austrian pine, which has real serious problems. The tips are kind of dying back. Is that what you're seeing on the tree?
They're all brown.
Is it a five needle or a two needle pine?
Oh my gosh! I think there's more. What do you mean by that?
Okay, they cut when you take off a needle. They come in bunches.
Oh wow!
At the base, they're wrapped together, and if you count the number of needles in each, it's called a fascicle that holds the bottom of the needles together. That will tell you if it's a two needle, five needle. Rarely do we have three needle, but it's usually two or five needle pines. And if it's a Swiss stone pine, it's going to be five. A white pine is five. An Austrian pine is only two.
Oh, so that's an easy way to tell.
Pardon?
Can I identify by a pine cone?
Yes, you can. If you send me a picture, I could try to identify by pine cone, but actually counting the number of needles really helps. There's a number of two-needle pines out there, and that's where the form of the plant, the actual cone, comes in handy.
Yeah, my suspicion for both either stone or Austrian pine would be there's a disease called Diplodia tiplite, which is a fungal disease. It's very, very common. It basically limits Austrian pine being useful in urban settings anymore. If you really want to know what it is, I would suggest get a sample into my clinic. We can verify that quite well. We have good control strategies if that's the disease.
Yeah.
But that's my suspicion, but I can't tell for certain just based on the description.
Swiss stone pines are usually pretty resistant compared to Austrian.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you can go ahead and get a sample in there. We just have a couple minutes left here, and we had two questions about burning bush on the Facebook page. Susan says, it looks like my burning bush is dead this year. It's probably 10 years old and growing in the middle of some yews and under a large tree. Yep. It looks like it was chewed on over the winter. And the other is I have aphids on my burning bush. I've never had to deal with them before.
Okay. The first question, the plant is dead, chewed at the winter. That's rabbit damage. Love burning bush.
Okay.
And in some ways, this is biological control. Burning bush, some cultivars can be very invasive. And regarding aphids,
that's a Phil Pelletier question. I would say contact. If you want to send me an email and I'll forward it on to Phil, I don't want to give his email out on over the air here, but you're welcome to email me that question directly and then we'll just forward it on to him and he can provide control.
And I'm actually pretty sure that Phil is on Tuesday, June 5th, if I'm remembering correctly. So we will definitely bring that up with Phil. Lots to talk about. So in just less than a minute left, Brian, why don't you give the website again for the plant pathology clinic?
Yeah, for my disease clinic, it's pddc.wisc.edu.
Great. And Laura, you have publications in the UW Learning Store?
Yes, and the Learning Store as well as the Urban Horticulture Team's website.
A lovely publication on lilacs, so check that out.
Oh, there you go. All right. Well, always so much to talk about, and thanks so much for spending the time with us today. Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at UW-Madison. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Glad to be here.
And Laura, Professor and Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, mine too.
Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for what's coming up next on the Ideas Network. Also, tune in on Monday. Monday's Memorial Day, and we will be enjoying our usual holiday talk about bird watching. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert will be joining us at 11 to talk about the spring migration and much more. Also, at 6 o'clock on Monday morning, Joy Cardine will be talking about general gardening. So you can tune in then. Thanks for listening.